Good evening. My name is Charles Goodhart, and I'm a retired professor of economics from LSE. But the man of this evening is Sebastian Mallaby, who is going to be talking to you about his latest book on Alan Greenspan. After leaving Oxford, where he got a first in modern history, Sebastian went on to The Economist, where he started in South Africa at the time when Nelson Mandela was being freed from jail. And he wrote a book after apartheid. He then went on with The Economist for a time in Tokyo, and then for a much longer time in Washington, where he shifted to the Washington Post, where he was a columnist and member of the board, and he continued to write books. He wrote a book on the world's banker, on the president of the World Bank at the time, Jim Wolfensohn, followed by another book on hedge funds entitled Richer Than God. He's currently a fellow at the Fellow of the Council of Foreign Relations and also at the Systemic Risk Center. But actually, the work that he's been doing for the last 5 years has been primarily writing this splendid book. After his talk is over, he's happy to answer some questions. And then you will all have bought, no doubt, copies of the book outside, and those of you who have bought copies can come up here and have Sebastian autograph them for you. Now, there are one or two other things I've been told that I've got to say, which is for those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for... I'm too old to know what the hell a hashtag is. The hashtag for today's event is #LSEGreenspan. Please put your phones on silent so that they don't ring and disrupt. This evening's events are being recorded and will hopefully be made available fairly soon. And as I said, after the lecture, he'll answer questions and then sign autograph books. So anyhow, we're tonight, let us welcome Sebastian Mallaby to talk about his book, The Man Who Knew the Life and Times of Alan Greenspan.
Can I go and talk up there? Is that good?
Please.
Okay, good. Right. Great. Well, it's nice to be here, and thank you all for coming out this evening. To expand just a little bit on what Charles was saying, this is my fourth book. It's my most ambitious book. By way of background, as Charles was saying, you know, I wrote one book in my 20s when I was in South Africa. I was outside Mandela's jail when he walked free when I was a journalist for The Economist. And so two things happened. First of all, I knew immediately that my career would be downhill after that, right, because nothing was going to be as exciting as watching Nelson Mandela come out of jail. And secondly, I spotted, being clever, that the all the other kind of journalistic books about South Africa were instantly out of date. So there was a gap in the market, and I wrote a book quickly about after apartheid. It was called After Apartheid, and it took me 3 months. That was in my 20s. Then in my 30s, I wrote this book, The World's Banker, about the World Bank, about Jim Wolfensohn, about development economics. This time, it didn't take me 3 months. It took me a year and 3 months. And then, that was in my 30s. In my 40s, the hedge fund book, More Money Than God, not more money, whatever, but More Money Than God. The point being that actually, J.P. Morgan, when he was at the peak of his powers in the early 20th century, was known as Jupiter because of his godlike power over Wall Street. And when I looked up his net worth at the time of his death in 1913, I realized that J.P. Morgan's net worth was less than what modern hedge fund makers, some hedge fund managers, some of them, were earning in a single year. So I figured, you know, more money than Jupiter, more money than God, that's good enough for a book title. And so I wrote that history of hedge funds. That didn't take me 3 months or a year and 3 months. It took me a bit more than 4 years. And now, that was in my 40s, now I'm here, I'm 52, and this book on Greenspan, more than 5 years. And my children say to me, not entirely kindly, that taking longer and longer and longer each time you write a book is not necessarily a good thing, nor is it necessarily a sustainable trajectory. So my first mission here this evening is to explain to you why I thought it was worth spending more than 5 years on this book, even though it actually amounts to almost half the lifespan of my youngest daughter. So the first reason I thought that Greenspan was a subject worthy of this amount of effort is simply that in terms of post-war finance, he really is the preeminent financial statesman, or the most significant, the most consequential financial statesman since 1945. I say this because if you think about the Federal Reserve, you think about the big names that you might associate with the Federal Reserve, which is, after all, the most powerful central bank. You might think of Paul Volcker, you might think of Ben Bernanke. Each of those people, very important in their own right, served for 8 years as chairman of the Fed. Greenspan, 18 and a half years. And if you add to that the time he was basically the chief economist in the Ford administration, he was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in the 70s. That was for 2.5 years, so you add that, you get a total period of 21 years. So I think clearly the most consequential post-war financial statesman. I could even be a bit cheeky and amp that up a bit and say, actually, not just finance. I mean, if you think about geopolitics, what is the single name that comes to mind most readily? Probably Henry Kissinger. Well, Henry Kissinger was in power for 8 years, not 21. So I tease my friend Neil Ferguson that he's writing 2 volumes and imposing that on the reading public about his guy who was an important figure in making policy for 8 years. My one, 21 years is slightly more, and I'm only doing 1 volume because I'm merciful towards the reading public. So that's the first reason why Greenspan was a subject worthy of more than 5 years of my attention. The second reason is that he went from being revered during the peak of his powers and the height of his tenure. He was the maestro because of the great moderation, this period of wonderful, almost uninterrupted growth, which was, by the way, shared prosperity with inequality falling in the late 90s for a brief period. So he was revered. And then the crisis came in 2008, and he went from hero to zero, from maestro to villain. This is the most acute and sudden reappraisal of a statesman's reputation that I can think of. So for a biographer to come in and try and set the judgment at the right level between hero and zero, presumably, that was an intriguing challenge for me as a writer. Then the third thing is that Greenspan turns out to be a fairly quirky person, more than I realized when I began. I like to tease audiences in Washington. You know, Washington, where I lived for 18 years, is somewhere where almost everybody thinks they know Alan Greenspan. They either claim to do, or they really do, or they read about him or something. So I say to these people, now, is Alan Greenspan the man you know, or is he the man you thought you knew? Because did you realize that, you know, he's not against marriage, for example. He's done it twice. But he was single between the age of 27 and 71. Now, this is a slightly eccentric choice by most people's standards. And in this interval, well, it's rather a long interval, but in this interval, he dated, and these are his words, not mine, he dated senators, beauty queens, news anchors. And I would add only the additional point that this was not always sequentially. He was also, I mean, we think of Greenspan as somebody who's in his suit, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's the somber central banker, very sober, the baritone quoting obscure statistics about freight car loading rates in the Midwest. But you have to remember also that he was the man who in 1959 bought himself the Buick Electra 225 convertible. We're talking the car that actually, it's like irrational exuberance made material. It's tail fins on the back to enlarge his shoulders. It's got that kind of, you know, angry, snarling radiator grille in the front, completely covered in chrome. I mean, it's a cross between, I don't know, a killer shark and a jet aircraft. And he would drive this thing down the East Highway in Manhattan at a pace which perhaps a modern central bank might not call a moderate pace. And so he would receive speeding ticket after speeding ticket, according to one of his ex-girlfriends anyway, and he would pay these quite happily because he was earning plenty of money and he barely noticed it. So Greenspan, a more interesting individual than people perhaps realize, but also, and more importantly, a much more interesting intellectual story. Now, the story of his intellectual trajectory is, I mean, I knew it was going to be quite fun. I didn't realize quite how much fun. And the first sort of inkling I got of the magnitude of the sheer enjoyment of this was when I was visiting him in the first year or so. I would go to his office, And I would sit there for maybe, you know, a couple of hours every week or two, asking him questions about his life, getting him to talk. It's kind of therapy for him, and it was research for me. And whenever I asked about his early intellectual development, I noticed him going like this. And after a while, I also looked like that. And I looked up, and there was a fat binder above my shoulder on the shelf. And a light went on in my head. It was kind of the sort of size of binder you might use for storing a PhD thesis. And Alan Greenspan's PhD had gone missing. Friends of mine who were journalists on the Wall Street Journal when Greenspan was the new Fed chairman had gone to New York University, which had issued Greenspan's PhD, and said to the librarian, we'd like to have a copy. Now, you're supposed to have it, right? If they issue the PhD, it's supposed to be in the library. And they said, sorry, it's lost. So all financial journalists in Washington wondered, was it really lost by mistake? Or was this one of those cases where you deliberately lose something on purpose because there's something in the PhD that maybe the Fed chairman doesn't want the journalist to get hold of? So there I am looking up at this folder, and I say, Alan, it would be great, you know, because we're talking about your early intellectual development, it would be great to have your PhD thesis like that. And seeing where I was looking, he gave it to me. So I got it back to my office, and I read it. And the main article in the PhD, it's about a collection of five or so articles. The main one, published in 1959, when Greenspan was 33 and about to get into that convertible 50s car, the main one is about how central banks must deal with asset price instability. I mean, that their central role is to fight bubbles. I mean, you couldn't make this up. Here is the maestro who is laid low in 2008 by the explosion of a financial bubble, and here he is at 33 years old saying that the thing a central bank should do is deal with asset price instability. His argument was that, you know, fluctuations in the business cycle caused by inventories are not that severe, but you know, look at the 1929 experience. Look what the Fed did in accommodating that bubble. That was a much bigger mistake, and therefore, obviously, central banks have to deal with asset bubbles. So that's the young Greenspan. What happened to the mature Greenspan? The mystery sucked me in. Then, a bit later, I knew that Greenspan had had this strangely close relationship with the libertarian novelist Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead and was a bit of a cult figure, in fact, remains a bit of a cult figure. And when Greenspan was sworn into office in his first White House, in his White House job in the mid-70s, he only invited three people to witness this. There was his mother, there was Ayn Rand, and Ayn Rand's husband. So they were extremely close. And passages of Atlas Shrugged, dealing with the steel industry or with economics, were basically edited by Greenspan. And so he was right there in the engine room with Ayn Rand. He was the de facto chief economist for Ayn Rand. And somebody told me that he had given a series of lectures under the auspices of the Ayn Rand Institute. So, of course, I wanted to find these lectures. And I had a hunch that because Ayn Rand was a notorious control freak, you couldn't go and give a lecture in her name without checking the text with her first. So this had to be written down somewhere. So I contacted various things called the Ayn Rand Institute for this and that, and none of them had it. And then I was following up on various leads I had of people who had known Greenspan in the 60s, including the person who had been employed to operate the computer in Greenspan's small economic consulting firm. So I get given this address. I drive out of Washington. It's about a two-hour drive out of town into the woods of Virginia. There is a cabin I find, kind of completely secluded. One person living inside, the former computer guy, and he has what biographers love. He has a basement full of materials. They are very well filed. And in there, because he's an Ayn Rand nut, there is the full transcript of Greenspan's speeches for the Ayn Rand Institute in 1963, 1964. The full map of my subject's mind as he crested his late 30s. So I got this home in a state of great excitement. I read the 300 pages, and in there, I came across the quote, "The creation of the Federal Reserve was a historic disaster." You couldn't make it up. The man who embodied the Federal Reserve, who personified the Federal Reserve for two decades, thought that it was a historic disaster that this thing had been created. So, I mean, I could go on, but the point here is that this is a life story, an intellectual story, of extraordinary evolution. You know, from somebody who believed in the gold standard and that you should never print money, to somebody who basically personified the printing of money. From somebody who believed you should never bail out anything ever, so that when President Ford said to New York City, that famous newspaper headline, "Ford to City, drop dead," actually that was Greenspan to City, drop dead, because Greenspan was the guy who advised Ford not to give the bailout to New York. So Greenspan went from total anti-bailout to the person who rescued the financial system so frequently in the period he was Fed chairman that he became famous for a thing called the Greenspan put, where traders took too much risk. Because Greenspan had their backs, they would call him Uncle Alan. Uncle Alan will take care of us. And he appeared on the cover of Time magazine as the chairman of the committee to save the world. So anti-rescue goes to super-rescue. So the ironies were wonderful, and the Shakespearean element of this guy who spotted the fatal flaw that central banks had to deal with and then was laid low himself by that same flaw was simply irresistible. So that was the third reason I found this project worthy of more than half a decade. The next reason, though, is something which really became clear to me only after I'd finished writing. But I'll mention it anyway. Because we live now in a period of the revolt against the establishment, the revolt against elites, the revolt against experts. And if you think about it, the ultimate empowered expert was Alan Greenspan. The revolt against experts is, in some sense, a revolt against the legacy of Alan Greenspan, because he was the empowered technocrat par excellence, the man who was not elected and yet wielded this extraordinary power over the global economy. So long as the power that he wielded seemed to have benign results, people not only tolerated that, they loved it. They called him the maestro. But then after 2008, when experts didn't seem to be delivering results for most people, then the pendulum swung, and now we live in this populist era of the revolt against the expert, and the revolt specifically against central banking experts, as we've seen both in the attacks on the Bank of England in the last few weeks and in Donald Trump's attacks on Janet Yellen, which have exceeded anything since the early 1990s in terms of a major party presidential nominee going after the Fed or the head of the Fed. So this is an entire sort of, you know, back to the future, return to some populist era before central banks were respected and before technocracy reigned. And my point to you is that if you want to understand how do technocrats fight back, how could this pendulum be made to swing back so that experts, possibly even experts here at LSE, might be given the proper respect that they are due, I think it would repay you to study the example and the career of Alan Greenspan. How did he achieve all this power? It wasn't just handed to him on a plate. He actually created it. He knew how to get it. When he took over the Fed in 1987, central banks were not necessarily respected by political leaders. His predecessor was the towering, Churchillian, rumpled Old Testament sage, Paul Volcker. And Paul Volcker is remembered as the kind of guy that nobody messed with. I mean, he was, you know, 6'7" for a start. But in fact, he was messed with. Ronald Reagan, in Volcker's second term, appointed people to be on the board of the Fed with Volcker who would vote against him. And so Volcker lost a vote on interest rates, which is almost unprecedented, and handed in his resignation. He was persuaded to take back that resignation letter, but then his own board outvoted him again twice on regulatory issues. So the towering Paul Volcker was surrounded by the Reagan administration, politically outsmarted, and he was a diminished sort of shadow of his former self by the time he left office in 1987. So then along comes Greenspan, and for the first few years, he too is attacked. At one point in the George H.W. Bush administration, there is the budget director, Richard Darman, who is going around Washington whispering, "This Greenspan, 65 years old, lives by himself, calls his mother every day. Bit creepy. Does this remind you of Hitchcock's Psycho?" So, I mean, this was a pretty vicious slandering campaign that Greenspan had to deal with. He was being pushed around. The Bush administration wanted him to cut interest rates, and he refused. He didn't just refuse. When he was being punched by the politicians, he punched them back. So Nick Brady, the Treasury Secretary, who was another adversary of Greenspan's, who kept on speaking publicly about how Greenspan got it all wrong, suddenly found that in the Wall Street Journal, on the very day that Nick Brady was going to testify in Congress, sitting next to Greenspan before a Senate committee, Brady suddenly finds that the front page of the Wall Street Journal has a very long article saying that Brady is too stupid to do the job of Treasury Secretary. Where did this come from? Well, I can tell you as a hint that when Kissinger asked the same question of his deputy when Kissinger was in the Ford administration, and Kissinger was faced with a negative story, saying that Kissinger was an idiot. He said to his deputy, "Where did this come from?" And the deputy said, "Oh, well, Greenspan gave that to the New York Times." And Kissinger said, "Oh, of course." Greenspan was good at this stuff. He knew how to leak to journalists. He was extremely close to the press. He was married to a journalist. He caught a journalist, and then he married one of them. And he was able to plant this story about Brady. Then Brady's sitting there here, and he's sitting here, and they're testifying. And at one point, Brady answers a question from the senator. And the senator turns to Greenspan and says, "Mr. Chairman, what the Treasury Secretary is saying is something, 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 so how do you respond?" And Greenspan paused and said, "I'm not entirely sure if I can fully follow what the Treasury Secretary appears to be trying to say." And the whole of the Senate committee just erupts in laughter because the reference to the New Wall Street Journal story pointing out that Brady sometimes was a bit vague in his grasp of economics was just devastating. And so basically the point is, if you mess with Greenspan, he messed with you back. He knew how to, Greenspan understood power, he liked power, he amassed power, he knew how to wield it, and that is how he became the empowered expert that people call the maestro. So I just hold that out as a message and a lesson and a role model for experts today who are feeling somewhat beleaguered. But let me come to the fifth and final reason why I wanted to spend more than half a decade writing this book. And it's actually the best reason. It's the reason I started with. It's the juiciest one. I've saved it for last, just for you. And this is that Alan Greenspan's public career maps perfectly onto the story of the making of modern finance. So Greenspan became an advisor to Richard Nixon in 1967. And at the time, currencies didn't fluctuate because the dollar was pegged to gold and other currencies were pegged to the dollar. Interest rates couldn't fluctuate much because there was Regulation Q capping the deposit rate on banks. And there were no financial derivatives. And then over the next four decades, during which Greenspan was at or near the center of power, the modern financial system with fluctuating interest rates and derivatives and securities and so forth, all of that was created. So it seemed to me at the outset, before starting this book, that if you wanted to understand why was the modern system created as it was created, why did people create a system that proved so fragile that it blew up and engulfed the world in 2008? These people were not foolish, presumably. So why did they do it? How did they make these decisions? I thought if you got into the car with the architect of the system, or the person who was closest to being the architect of the system, and you drive over that terrain, understanding why did they make this judgment at this point? Why did they decide this other thing at that point? That is the best way to understand how the modern system was created. And by pursuing the story of Greenspan through to the end of his career, one understands how the whole thing blew up, because he left the Fed in 2006, just a year before the wheels started to come off the financial system. So the question is, having done that research, having got into the sort of metaphorical car with the architect and driven across that landscape, what conclusions do I come up with? The first thing is that, contrary to some conventional wisdom, we did not have a crisis because a bunch of laissez-faire ideologues were in charge. Right? There's a view that, Greenspan and a few other people, Larry Summers, had this naive belief in the self-policing efficiency of financial markets. So with that kind of naive person in charge, no wonder the whole thing blows up. Well, that's just not true. Greenspan never really believed in market efficiency. He bought himself a seat on the Commodities Exchange in New York in the 1950s and 60s precisely because he believed that markets were so inefficient that he could trade against them and make money. He wrote that the central bank had centrally to fight asset bubbles and market overshoots, as I was just saying earlier. He pursued this preoccupation with financial overshoots and instability into his tenure as Fed chairman. So when you read the transcripts of the Fed's Interest Rate Committee, the FOMC, you see him repeatedly talking about builds up of risk here and possible bubbles there. The idea that he couldn't diagnose a bubble is just not true. He talked about them a lot. So, and how could it be any other way? I mean, this is a person who lived through every single financial crisis from Penn Central in 1970 through the Latin American debt crisis in the 1980s, the first too big to fail bailout, which took place in 1984 with the bailout of Continental Illinois. As soon as he became Fed chairman in 1987, the first thing that happens is that Wall Street crashes 23% in one day. I mean, the idea that he sat there and thought, oh, this is all efficient and stable, of course he didn't. You know, then he lived through Mexico collapsing again in 1995, Russia defaulting, long-term capital management, the big hedge fund collapsing, the NASDAQ collapsing. Of course he didn't think that markets were properly priced all the time. And nor, by the way, did Larry Summers. In a paper he wrote with André Schleifer in the late 1980s, Summers and Schleifer wrote a line to the effect of, if the efficient market hypothesis were a stock, it would have crashed along with the stock market in October 1987. In other words, when the market corrects by 23% in one day, only a fool would call the whole thing obviously efficient. So these are people who thought about market inefficiencies much more deeply than most of the critics who say that they believe everything to be efficient. The reason why we had the system that we got is not because of naive believers in the self-policing efficient in markets. It's because of other deeper factors. So one was inflation, another one was technology, another one was globalization. Let me explain what I mean. Inflation. So inflation was the force that rendered those caps on interest rates inoperable. Whether the cap was 2% or 3%, that was fine if inflation was kind of 1.5%. But by the late 60s, as it started to edge up, it meant that banks were paying nothing or maybe even a negative amount to depositors. And so depositors were not having it. They were pulling their money out of the banks, putting it in the bond markets, and there were these destabilizing flows of money as a result of regulation that couldn't deal with rising inflation. And it wasn't just people of a laissez-faire disposition who saw this. James Tobin, who won a Nobel Prize later, the Yale professor who advised John F. Kennedy, and who was by no means a laissez-faire, this person was identified with democratic economics, wrote a paper in 1970 saying, obviously, we need to get rid of these regulations on interest rates. So this was a bipartisan expert consensus that inflation rendered interest rate regulation non-functional. Globalization, why do I mention that? Well, it was global flows of payments that created the balance of payments imbalances that put pressure on the dollar and made the dollar-gold link untenable after 1971, whereupon Nixon took the dollar off gold. And as currencies started to fluctuate, then, of course, people traded currencies, speculated in currencies. Then there were currency derivatives. So that whole segment of currency trading and currency swaps and so forth was made possible and pushed by globalization. Then there's technology. A friend of mine, who's now at Nomura, Lewis Alexander, calculated that the computer hardware that you need in order to calculate the proper cost of a complex financial security crashed by 99%, or more than 99%, between 1970 and 1990. So when the cost of making a security crashes by more than 99%, obviously the supply of these securities is going to go up. And as the supply of securities went up, then Glass-Steagall, the traditional split between traditional banks and securities business, came under pressure to break down. So that's why I bring technology into the story. So I think these deep forces, not ideology, are what really drove the creation of the modern financial system. But it doesn't mean that the regulators should not have responded. So I'm exonerating the people in power from proactively going out and deliberately deregulating because they had some kind of laissez-faire ideology. But, of course, seeing that finance was evolving because of technology, because of globalization, they should have responded with measures to make it safer. Some obvious examples of this include something on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the enormous housing lenders in the U.S., which blew up in 2008, which were way too big, taking much too much risk. They should have been reined in. Over-the-counter derivatives, they should have been pushed onto exchanges. Extreme securitization of the subprime variety should have been reined in. These things are clear, but why weren't they reined in? The story I discovered in my research is basically it wasn't a lack of desire to do so as much as political obstacles to doing so. The reason I say this is that on derivatives regulation, for example, Bob Rubin, the Treasury Secretary at the time in 1998, when this issue was most hotly discussed in Washington, actually wanted to regulate derivatives, as did the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. But But they made a judgment that if they tried to regulate derivatives, Wall Street lobbyists would jump on their heads, there would be a massive fight in Congress, at the end of the day they wouldn't get what they wanted, and they would have burned up all their effort and not achieved anything. This is a period when passing what became known as the Glass-Steagall Repeal Act, which did go through in 1999, took about 14 attempts of bills being introduced in Congress from about 1990 to 1999. It was not simple, given the nature of Washington, given the nature of Congress, given the nature of money in politics, to get that reform done. So I think politics on derivatives explains a lot. I think the same story is true of subprime mortgage regulation. Thanks to the Freedom of Information Act in America, you can get the transcripts of the debates inside the Fed about whether they should do something about extreme securitization. And you can read them in 2001, Greenspan and Ned Gramlich, the governor who was most concerned with this stuff, discussing what to do. And they did pass new rules at the end of 2001. And the Fed staff calculated and predicted that this would reduce about one-third of the most dangerous, most crazy kinds of mortgages. The problem was that when the staff redid this study 5 years later, instead of axing out a third of the bad mortgages, it reduced only 1%. Why? Because it was too easy for the financial industry to root around the rules by tweaking the products, and because the balkanized system of regulation in the U.S. is so extreme that although the Fed makes the rules, the enforcers of the rules are a bunch of other alphabet soup agencies. And in the case of non-banks originating mortgages, it was the FTC, the Fair Trade Commission, which actually has no supervisors to do the supervision. They are only an enforcement agency who will bring a lawsuit against somebody if somebody complains. They don't proactively supervise at all. So with zero supervisors, it's not surprising that the supervision was not much good. So these are the kinds of reasons: balkanization of regulation, the ease of rooting around regulation, the politics involved in dealing with derivatives, which inhibited more action. And the same is true on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. When Greenspan tried to push for regulation on that, lo and behold, there was a television advertisement which showed a nice couple talking to each other about their desire to get into the American dream and buy their home. And the man says to the woman, "Oh dear, I've heard that in Congress they're going to take away our home. We were going to get that lovely home, and now they're going to stop us." And the wife says, "Oh no, that's terrible. I hate those politicians." And the point of the ad was just a shot across the bows to tell members of Congress that if you vote for these Greenspan reforms, which are going to rein in Freddie and Fannie, don't expect to be re-elected, because we will come after you in your district at the next election. We will run these ads. We've got plenty of money to do so. So this all leads up to the final point I want to make before I will stop giving you my Fidel Castro treatment. And that is as follows. If you think that regulation is very much inhibited by political constraints, and if you think, as I think, that that hasn't gone away, I mean, after all, the political climate in Washington has not exactly got easier, right, in the last 10 years, if you look at the current election going to be held tomorrow. So if regulation is constrained by divided politics, do we really think that regulation is going to save us from the next financial bust? I think I'm happy for people to try. I think they should try, by all means. I do not think it's going to work. I think macroprudential tools, this buzzword of the idea that the regulators will be watching out, and if they see some excess risk which might turn too bubbly, they're going to jump on that with regulation. Maybe in the UK context, where enormous amounts of power have been centralized in the hands of the Bank of England, maybe. In America, forget it. It's way too balkanized. There are way too many lobbies. There are way too many political obstacles. And because I believe that to be the case, I also think that interest rates have to be used as additional support to fight dangerous asset bubbles. This is a controversial view, but it's how I conclude my book. Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman until 2014, flatteringly wrote a long post on his blog last week about my book, in which he says it's great and so forth, but he disagrees with this bit. Well, it's not surprising, because he helped to create the consensus of which I am skeptical, the consensus that interest rate tools should only be used as a very last resort to fight asset bubbles. It seems to me that having lived through 2008, having seen how the busting of that bubble is still affecting not only our economies, but frankly also our politics. We need to use every tool at our disposal to fight the next bubble. I do not believe regulation is enough. So my critique of Greenspan in the last resort and my plea to future central bankers is to be willing to use interest rates as well. Thank you very much.
That was a great presentation. And now we have a chance, you have a chance, to ask questions. Well, I'll start off then. The present mainstream view is you leave interest rates to maintain price stability and you use macro-pru measures to try and deal with asset price bubbles. Why can't we rely on macro-pru to do that?
Well, Charles, you're in good company. Most people agree with you and they don't agree with me. And that was sort of the point that Ben Bernanke was also making. And the reason I don't agree with it is the historical research I did suggests to me strongly that these political obstacles to using regulation are very, very strong. And therefore, I just don't think it's likely to be enough to stop the next bubble, to rely on regulation. Regulation is, you know, particularly if you use it in the macro-pru paradigm, involves not just passing a rule and leaving it there, it involves changing the rule according to the conditions in the markets. If you see excess leverage building up somewhere, you're supposed to act quickly and respond. Well, that sort of flexible use of regulation, at least in the United States, is totally unrealistic. I mean, you know, you get sued. Right now, there's a professor at Harvard, a law professor called Hal Scott, who is filing a lawsuit against the Treasury because it's trying to use an administrative procedure over something to do with regulating finance. I forget which one. And he's saying, no, under the Administrative Procedures Act, you have to put this rule out to comment for 3 months and then further comment for another 3 months. So it's just completely otherworldly. And so I'm confronted with this repeated conversation I have with my friends in Washington who are in decision-making positions at the Treasury or at the Fed, where they say, no, we're going to use macro-pru. And I say, really? Do you think it'll really work? And they say, no, not really. And I say, well, then maybe you should consider something else. Perhaps interest rates should be used as well. No, couldn't do that. I think you could.
In the middle. Can you wait for the microphone to reach you? And we'll go first with the man with less hair and then with the man with more hair.
That's very kind of you.
I believe it. That's a very good hierarchy. I like that.
Yeah, so I'm in good company. My question is that isn't one of the problems with central bankers is, I mean, as you said, the Greenspan's biggest concern was to stop asset bubbles. But there's other things that central bankers are supposed to do. They're supposed to make sure inflation doesn't go too high. They're supposed to make sure unemployment doesn't go too high, that there's growth in the economy. Isn't the biggest problem that they don't really know exactly what they're supposed to be doing?
Well, I think it's true that, you know, if you can reduce the mission to one objective, and you've got basically one tool, which is the interest rate, you move up and down, that feels like a much more elegant position to be in. And that's why inflation targeting, where essentially you state the central bank's mission only in terms of delivering an inflation which is around 2%, is incredibly attractive to central bankers because it does simplify things and you're not left with this thing, okay, I've got one tool, but should I yank it this way because I'm worried about jobs or that way because of inflation or another way because of financial stability? That is a complicated world to be in. But my view is that the world is complicated. And, you know, if you try to simplify things because it's intellectually elegant and makes your life easier, and then you let bubbles take place like 2008, it's not a good outcome.
So my question is slightly related to that, because you know, back before the financial crisis in sort of, I don't know, 02, 03, 04, there was quite a lively debate going on as to whether or not central banks should be acting against bubbles or just focused on inflation. And I'm just curious, you know, why has that debate gone away, and why is your view kind of controversial now?
I think the debate is still simmering on. In fact, there's a new paper that was just sent to me last week presented at the IMF just a few days ago on this question of whether you should use interest rates to address asset bubbles. So there's still a debate. And I think the majority view is that you should not use interest rates. But what this reminds me of slightly, and I'm going to take a slight digression here, but we are at LSE, so I hope some of you will appreciate this. So what this reminds me of is the debate about modern portfolio theory in the 1960s. So what happened was, in the origins of modern academic finance, people made a bunch of assumptions, including that the distribution of the price changes in the market followed a normal distribution. And along came Mandelbrot, Benoit Mandelbrot, who said, excuse me, that's simply wrong. When I look at the distribution of price changes empirically, they don't follow a normal distribution. Extreme changes, which are either markets crashing or markets jumping, are way more common, especially the crashes, than you would predict in a bell curve normal distribution. So it's just simply wrong. The first response to Mandelbrot's objection from, I think it was Eugene Farmer, one of the founders of academic finance, was, oh yes, you're right, that's quite true. For a while, the Mandelbrot critique was accepted. But then what happened was, as you moved into the 70s, it was too much fun to price options and make all these big breakthroughs in how you think about finance using the bell curve assumption. So people said, well, it's not quite right, but, there's a caveat here, but let's just focus on the fun stuff, which is we're going to price options now. And, Nobel Prizes were awarded and whole industries were created around the progress that was made by essentially sweeping Mandelbrot under the table. And I kind of think that a bit about inflation targeting, that we've built this massive consensus around inflation targeting while sweeping under the carpet the reality that actually inflation ain't the worst thing that can happen to an economy. One of the funny stories I tell in my book is about Greenspan's attempts to rationalize a focus on inflation. So he was persuaded at one point that productivity gains in the economy would be higher if you could have lower and more stable inflation. So he got some economists at the Fed and said, okay, it's your job to really look for this relationship. And, it's kind of the mid-90s. People had cell phones, but they were still sort of very big and the battery ran out all the time. But he would use his cell phone from the car to call out this economist all the time and say, have you run the next regression? And they're looking for this relationship. And at the end of the day, there simply wasn't one. There was no relationship between lower inflation and higher productivity growth. So, Charles may have a slightly different view, but my sense of the literature on this is that it's really very difficult to find a lot of evidence beyond just the intuition that it's bad for people. People don't like the pound in their pocket being one thing worth one thing today and another thing next month. I mean, people, instinctively don't like inflation. It's better not to have high inflation, of course. But what is the real penalty for high inflation? It's actually not a very easy thing to demonstrate. Whereas I think the cost of asset bubbles after 2008 is fairly clear. So in my view, there is a whole consensus out there. It hasn't gone away. The debate is still there, but it's the consensus conclusion is wrong.
You'd like to pass the microphone over.
Sticking with the interest rate topic, so there's a couple of points. Firstly, you alluded to the fact that you have one tool which then has multiple impacts in different areas of finance and different areas of the economy. So how do you rationalize that? Point one. Point two, interest rates have a floor in theory. Obviously, we've seen a number of central banks in Europe go to below zero. There are a lot of people who don't like that. So where I appreciate that, macroprudential supervision and regulation is slow, but unlike interest rates, it does provide you with the flexibility to actually target in a way that interest rates don't and actually have a limit on where you can go with them.
Hmm. Well, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in that question. One point is that, if you think about the financial system, it's not clear that targeted interventions are that effective in the sense that, classically, if you think that banks are taking too much risk and you come down on them and say, you've got to hold more capital, hold more liquidity, then the risk will migrate to non-banks. You squeeze the balloon here and the risk moves over there. So in fact, and this is Jeremy Stein of Harvard who makes this argument, it's quite good to have a monetary response because monetary policy gets into the cracks. The bits that you would miss with regulation, you get with interest rates. So I think the first part of your question is totally right. I agree with it. It is complicated when you try to pursue both financial stability and stable inflation and full employment with one tool. It's very difficult. And so there are times when you're just going to have to not prioritize asset bubbles. So Sweden in 2010 did raise interest rates to discourage too much household borrowing. And that turned out to be a mistake because they did this at a time when the economy was weak, inflation was below target, employment was below trend, there was the euro crisis going on, it was a bad time to raise rates. So I'm not saying you should always think about asset markets as the priority, that would be way too simple. I am saying that if you have full employment, inflation is around target or a bit above, and you see asset markets going totally nuts, like the NASDAQ did in 1999, or like real estate did in 2005, then you should act with interest rates.
Are you there? Can you pass the back to the man in the blue shirt? Sweater.
Isn't the problem that nobody wants to spoil the party? I mean, even if Greenspan agrees that, you know, asset prices should have been targeted at the beginning of his career, you know, in the end, him and nobody else wants to be the person that remembered as, you know, no one thanks you for, you know, stopping the party and bull markets.
Yeah.
And it's an asymmetric problem, because if it's the other way around, no one remembers you.
Yeah, I think that's basically sums up the whole problem. I mean, I totally agree with that. And, as I argue in my book, the title is The Man Who Knew, in the sense that he did know that finance was unstable. He did know markets were inefficient. He'd written about it since he was in his 30s. And he repeated these concerns right up into 2004, 2005. You know, even as the mortgage bubble was inflating, there he was saying to his colleagues, this is looking a bit scary. So he was the man who knew. But as you say, he was not the man who acted. Now, maybe central bankers will never act. That's the question. And I make an argument in my book that, you know, it's a bit relevant to think about Greenspan's personality in this regard. As a shy person who didn't like face-to-face confrontation, who could be quite tough in a devious way, sort of leaking stuff about you in the press, but didn't like to fight you face-to-face. And I think it would have involved a lot of direct confrontation for Greenspan to have ended the party by raising rates. You know, there was a consensus around the Fed that said it's okay for the Fed to raise interest rates to stabilize the price of eggs, but not to stabilize the price of nest eggs. You know, if you'd raised interest rates to kill everybody's savings, that would not have been popular. And he flinched.
Could I change the subject slightly onto the question of the dollar? Two parts to it. What was Greenspan's thinking in terms of the impact on the rest of the world from his actions as a Fed? Was there some sort of view he took? And secondly, obviously the dollar's the all-powerful currency, but you pointed out there's a regulatory risk at the heart of the system. Is there a case for trying to rebalance away at the global level towards other currencies as well? Clearly that was a euro's position, but this danger you're mentioning about the regulatory risk in the heart of the US financial system does, with the dollar being such a strong currency, does raise concerns.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great pair of questions. I mean, I actually found remarkably little of interest to say about Greenspan's involvement with the rest of the world, because frankly, I don't think he thought about it very hard. And there were times when crises came to Washington and he couldn't avoid them. So the Mexico crisis in 1995, the East Asian crisis in 1997, Russia a little bit in 1998. But, you know, he avoided this stuff as long as he could do, and it was really not on his radar for most of the time. And so this makes your point that, you know, the dollar is going to be managed by central bankers who care about the United States. They're not going to be thinking about spillover effects on emerging markets and so forth. And, you know, Helen Ray and others have written very well about how dramatic these spillover effects can be, particularly on, you know, Mexico or countries that are obviously kind of in the dollar's shadow. So this is a big issue. And I think that rebalancing the global financial system away from the dollar is both a good idea and very difficult. I think it would be healthy for the system. And when I talk in America, people often say, oh, we want the dollar to remain a reserve currency all the time. And I say, well, the problem is it might do. It would actually be better for the United States and better for the rest of the world to have a more balanced system of holding reserves in multiple currencies.
Well, I'm going to ask another question, which is, towards the beginning of your most excellent talk, you said what a great political operator that Alan was, and you end by saying, but he didn't do anything about asset bubbles that he could see because he was frightened of confrontation with Congress. Now, is there a bit of an inconsistency there? And also, could it not be that he drank too much of the Kool-Aid of the praise that had been washing over him, and he actually thought he could cope with whatever came in the way of a crisis by operating the Greenspan put?
Yeah, I think there's certainly truth in the idea that he became a little bit too confident in his own magical ability. If people call you the maestro for a decade, you end up believing it. His wife did collect the Greenspan memorabilia, the Greenspan T-shirts, the Greenspan dolls, et cetera, the Greenspan cartoons. So there was a little bit of that. People understand that he was turned into this sort of household name, folk hero. He would appear on the TV and they would film his briefcase close up and they would say, oh, look, if the briefcase is thin, it means he's not reading very much, so he's not worried about the world, so interest rates will stay the same. If it's fat, watch out, he's going to change interest rates because he's obviously done more reading. What people don't realize is that this wasn't just the TV people doing this. This was Greenspan actively cooperating with the request from the TV studio that he should walk down the street with his briefcase like this, because normally he would be driven into the car park beneath the Fed building and he would take the lift up to his office. So, you know, Greenspan was the supply side of the Greenspan maestro phenomenon, even if the demand side was created by cable TV. So, I think there is a bit of drinking your own Kool-Aid, and I don't think it's healthy in the end to run an institution for 18 and a half years. By the end of your tenure, everybody who's in a senior position is there because you appointed them to that position. And so they're not disposed to challenge you, and I think that's unhealthy. So, yes, is the answer on that bit. I think there was a first part to your question, which I'm now forgetting, but perhaps you've forgotten too, so that's all right.
No, it was just that, and if he was such a great political operator, why was he so frightened about taking on Congress? And he did have a position. He was the maestro. And if he was prepared to take a position, wouldn't he have taken quite a lot of the senators and Congress with him by the time of 2004, 2005, 2006?
But, Charles, you know, I think this is a bit in the nature of asking me the question. So this guy, Barack Obama, he's a politician, right? I mean, he's a pretty good politician. He got elected twice. So why couldn't he take on Congress and get, you know, much more done on climate change? I mean, there isn't really a contradiction. There is instead, you know, a tension. There is the reality that Greenspan was a great political operator. He learned his tricks in the Nixon campaign. I mean, without giving away the entire, you know, fun stories in the book, he got involved in a dirty trick in the Nixon period in the White House, where Chuck Colson, who later went to jail for Watergate, got Greenspan to cooperate in a dirty trick about the Fed. Well, I won't say more about that, but the point is that, you know, through time, Greenspan again and again was pretty canny politically. When Ford wanted to be on Reagan's ticket as the vice presidential candidate, he got Greenspan to help negotiate the political deal to get him on the ticket. I mean, he's a very political figure. There is no doubt about that. But there's limits to his political power, just like there's limits to Obama's power. And he tried on Fannie and Freddie, and he really did try. He went off and testified. I tell the story in my book, and they ran TV ads against him. And, you know, however powerful and however much of a maestro he was, you know, his reputation couldn't save a member of Congress from being beaten in the next election by a barrage of TV ads paid for by the lobbyist. So I think that's how it turned out. You know, he was politically savvy, but not unlimited power, and he understood the limits to that power, and so he tactically avoided certain confrontations.
Over there.
You haven't mentioned Greenspan's own account of the events of the crash and afterwards. How instructive or otherwise is his account of what happened and why he acted as he did?
Well, the most famous part of his account about what happened is the famous line when he went to testify in Congress after 2008. He was sort of hauled in and made to account for the fact that the world had blown up and wasn't this his fault. He let loose this quote, "I found a flaw. I found a flaw in my worldview. I found a flaw in my ideology." And this was absolutely juicy to any, you know, journalist or whatever. There's a documentary called The Flaw. So this became a bit of a Greenspan meme. And in my view, this is not massively helpful to understanding what he really got wrong. Because the notion that there was a flaw in his worldview makes it sound as if this was fundamentally an intellectual error, that he had this understanding, he was operating on his understanding, and that's what went wrong. As I've tried to explain, you know, his understanding was more nuanced than that would imply. I mean, he did understand that things could blow up. He did understand that you had to regulate things sometimes. He supported more regulation of accounting rules, for example, after the Enron crisis, as well as supporting that subprime regulation which got circumvented, but at least he supported something. And he did support an effort on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So this flaw in a kind of totally trusting attitude towards the markets, well, he didn't totally trust them. So I think that's unfortunate, that quote, because it's diverted people's attention from the real source of the trouble, which is that politics constrains action in Washington, D.C. And that hasn't changed. In fact, it's got worse.
I'll ask a somewhat unfair counterfactual, because I'm trying to disentangle the persona of Greenspan from the era, the economic configuration through which he lived. So the counterfactual is, if Greenspan were to come to the position of Federal Reserve Chairman in 2008, would he have chosen to fight the banking regulations? Would he feel uncomfortable about the fact that all the burden of adjustment falls on the banks, central banking, rather than fiscal measures? And would he have been successful if he were to choose those trajectories? Would he have been successful given his persona, or the configuration of the era would simply not have allowed him to do anything?
That's a very good question. So I think the first thing that one can say with some confidence is that Greenspan would have been even quicker than Bernanke to bail out the system after Lehman went down. I can say that with confidence because he actually gave an interview in that small window of time between Lehman going down and between the Fed deciding to act. And he said, "You got to act." I mean, there was no doubt. He'd seen these crises time after time. He believed in rescuing the system early and often, and he would have been even faster than Bernanke on that. Your next question is about what would have been the post-crisis regulatory system. And I think on that, it would have been pretty similar to what happened. I don't think he would have fought. I mean, my observation of how he interacted with disputes about regulation in the 90s and the 2000s is essentially that he fought hard to protect the Fed's turf. He did not fight to either frustrate regulation or to try to increase it a couple of times. But he would not have been standing in the way of Dodd-Frank. He might have tried to, you know, massage it at the margins, but then so did Bernanke. So I don't think that would have been massively different. Then the next point in your question is, what about the balance of stimulus between central banks and fiscal policy? Of course, it's true that central banks have been called upon to do too much. They've been seen as supermen. If you Google Bernanke Superman, you get pictures of Bernanke, you know, ripping off his shirt and tie to expose that spandex thrilling S on the Superman shirt. You know, that Superman stuff has been overdone. It's been pushed too far. We ought to have more budget stimulus and less monetary stimulus. And I think Greenspan might well have been more effective than Janet Yellen in putting the onus back onto Congress because he is so politically skilled. And I think, finally, just a quick point which you didn't ask but I think is relevant, is that today Yellen is being attacked, the Fed is being attacked from all sides in the US. So there are a bunch of people, you know, Larry Summers being a prominent example, who think the Fed is too tight, inflation is still too low, and the Fed should be looser. Then there are people who think that there are asset bubbles being inflated and the Fed is too loose and should be tighter, so the opposite critique. Then there is Donald Trump, who thinks Janet Yellen is in the pocket of Barack Obama. Then there is Hillary Clinton, who thinks that the regional Feds should be reorganized and restructured in a way that they have not been since the 1930s. So the Fed is being picked at from all directions. And there isn't a very effective response. Why? Because if you ask the question of the sort of signal coming in from the Fed these days, what proportion is Janet Yellen? I think most people would say less than 50%. If you'd ask the same question in the Greenspan era of the signal coming in from the Fed, how much is Alan Greenspan's voice? The answer would have been 99.9%. I mean, he just dominated the institution. And if other Fed governors wanted to make speeches that he didn't approve of, he found that there was a church hall a very long way away which needed a speaker at 10 p.m. with a hostile audience, and he would send them to do it. So I think that what that meant was that the Fed spoke with one powerful, clear, effective voice and could fight back against critics and could defend its institutional turf and could command respect in a way that I'm afraid Janet Yellen has not done.
But does that mean that you think committees are wrong, that you want single people taking decisions? I thought that most of the recent sort of research suggested that decisions taken by committees tended to be better than decisions taken by individuals, and you're taking the opposite view.
No, I agree with that position in terms of making a decision about monetary policy. I don't agree that then everybody should go out and communicate their own view all the time. I mean, I think there's a difference between the messaging and the arrival at the decision. Is that fair?
It's, as you will appreciate, it's entirely opposite to the ethos of the British MPC, which is that everyone should be able to stand up for their decision, and their individual decisions should actually be known.
Yeah, I mean, probably that works. So this is an interesting question. So I guess the answer to this will emerge more clearly in the next year or two if we have a continued run of political criticism of the Bank of England. It seems to me that in a time when technocrats are riding high, they can afford to display their differences. At a time when they are under attack, it might pay them to speak with more unity. But, you know, it's a good question.
Both of Greenspan's successors pointed to the rise in the S&P 500 as evidence of success of their policies. It is a bubble with almost certainty. Has Greenspan expressed an opinion about that, or did you talk with him about whether he thinks those policies have been successful?
I mean, Greenspan these days is keen on rumbling about how, you know, creating this much money historically has always caused trouble in the end. It's not a specific comment on the level of the stock market. It's a more general comment that QE infinity is not a good idea. And so that's where he is on that. But I do think that your question points up an interesting irony, which is that part of the premise of QE is that monetary policy will affect asset prices. And therefore, the consensus view, which is that you can't prick a bubble with monetary policy, is somewhat contradictory. I mean, either you can affect asset prices or you can't. So somebody like Chairman Bernanke, who invented QE, or at least put it into practice first, part of the premise of which was that he was going to affect asset prices, it's interesting that now, in commenting on my book last week, he thinks that the central bank can't always affect asset prices. So this is the debate I'm having with him.
Please, wait for the mic.
Just coming.
In terms of the political constraints that Obama and Greenspan faced, is there any chance with the lobbying state in the US, is there any chance of any changes being made to securities derivatives, or is it just going to become like where the CDOs became bespoke tranche opportunities? Is there just going to be a constant rebranding of the same products, or is it just going to, will something change?
That's a good question. I mean, as you probably know, after the crisis, as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms, there was an effort to push more over-the-counter derivatives onto exchanges where the risks can be better monitored and isolated and they can be netted out. And that's a good thing. But I think there's always a risk, and I'm sure there are people in the room who know the internal entrails of these markets more than I do, but there is always a risk that banks always want to create more over-the-counter derivatives because they're more profitable. And unless you constantly tell them, oh, this is a new thing, I mean, normally the regulatory attitude is, if it's very new and you've just invented some new funky over-the-counter derivative which is tailored to hedging a particular unusual risk, you can't put that on an exchange because it's not standard yet. But then if it matures, it becomes standard, then it should be moved onto an exchange. And the challenge for regulators is to be vigilant and jump on products that have become standardized enough to move onto exchange, because the industry won't want to, because they make more money by dealing bilaterally with their clients. And one of the wrinkles is that I think there's a sort of there's a weird thing. You might say, well, why would the clients put up with that? Surely if you're Shell and you want to hedge your exposure to a change in the value of the euro against the Japanese yen, you'd rather pay less commission for that, right? So wouldn't you be pushing your intermediary, JP Morgan or whoever, to do this on an exchange, not over the counter? Well, that's actually not right, because the person who is the treasurer of the oil company has a sort of comfortable feeling when they get an over-the-counter derivative which hedges out a risk and is not marked to market, so you don't see it fluctuating in value. So nobody's looking over the shoulder of the corporate treasurer and saying, oi, you bought that hedge here, you've just lost, you know, 20% on this thing, you crazy? When it's bought as a hedge, he would rather just put it in a drawer, have the contract and be protected. So there's this sort of strange thing where the people who are being ripped off by over-the-counter derivatives kind of like being ripped off because of the politics inside their own companies.
We have to leave time for all of you to go outside, buy the book, and come back and have it autographed by Sebastian. So can we now thank Sebastian in the standard way for a really most excellent lecture.